Hello, everyone, and welcome back to an all-new episode of The Financial Confessions. It's me, your host, Chelsea Fagan, founder and CEO of The Financial Diet, and woman who loves to talk about money. And today I am so, so excited because I have a guest with whom I have had a parasocial relationship for some time. I've been following her for a while. I love her content. She has so many fascinating things to say about style and consumerism and what we should be investing in versus what is not worth it, like all of the many questions that we ask ourselves all the time here at TFD. She's also, for those who know, a bit of a style icon herself and a bit of a maven. And also, I found out just in the few minutes before we started filming, has many overlapping sort of backstories and histories with myself. We're actually both Maryland girls. We both lived in DC for a time. I actually worked in a coffee shop very close to where she lived. The stars are aligning, suffice to say. And we have a lot of really interesting things to talk about. So I'm not even going to waste a second more time. I'm just going to introduce my guest, Heather Hurst, aka Pig Mommy.
Hi, Chelsea flatters me. I've also been in a mutually parasocial relationship with her for years, so I'm so excited to be here.
And thanks to Delete Me for supporting TFC. Remove your personal info from data broker websites. And we have a special discount for you. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and use promo code TFC.
First and foremost, why Pig Mommy?
My dog's name is Pig. Her name is Ziggy, her government name, but it just evolved into Pig. Nobody calls her Ziggy. Everyone calls her Pig. She only gets called Ziggy when she's in trouble. And I made a TikTok for fun. My friend and I were joking about a username. That stuck. Now it feels like it's too late to change it, but I don't like going to networking events and having to tell 50-year-old men that
your name is Pig
My
Mommy.
Name is Pig Mommy.
That's like our resident investing expert here at The Financial Diet. She's a dear friend, Amanda Holden, but her like handle is Dumpster Doggy.
I love her.
She's the best. She talk about someone who's really into good vintage shopping. Okay, so to give just a quick bit of context for our audience. So you are someone who worked in many, many different fields. You were a nanny, a personal chef. You worked in the healthcare science space, is that right?
Yeah, scientific operations.
Public health. Had a very sort of like 9-to-5, more corporate life. And then as of about a year ago, you started pursuing full-time. So you're a vintage reseller, and that is a huge part of your income, I would assume.
A little bit. I like to actually keep that more of a hobby.
Oh.
Because I, yeah.
Well, we'll get into that.
Okay.
So you're a vintage reseller. You're a creator. You are a serial side hustler. Can you talk a little bit just about sort of what you would consider to be your work today?
Yes. So moving more towards personal styling, I just launched personal styling services about 2 weeks ago. I have about 8 clients right now. So I kind of do that in supplementation with my content creation, moving more away from content. So my day-to-day is mostly styling clients and then trying to take some of that styling content that I get from my clients and moving it back on to TikTok and then having them sort of like ping pong back and forth.
Wow.
Like an ecosystem of styling.
Okay. And so as I mentioned, you were very much like you sort of worked for, I would assume, fairly wealthy families as, you know, a domestic employee, been there.
Mm-hmm.
And from there moved on to the public health space where you were a 9-to-5 corporate girly. How did we get here? How did we leave the corporate world?
Slowly and then all at once. Whatever the quote is about falling asleep, that's
yes.
Kind
like
of how
you
it
fall
went.
In love like you fall asleep.
Yes.
What is that from?
I don't
know.
Is
that from The Fault in Our Stars?
It might be.
Not the Green Brothers invading
yeah.
this episode against
an industry
my will.
Plan.
That was a paid ad.
That was a paid ad. And you can subscribe 10% off their books. The journey from moving from 9-to-5 content creation, basically when COVID had happened and we were stuck working at home, I gained back hours in the day, as many of us did, not having to commute multiple hours to my job. I lived with a best friend and both of us ran the vintage business together. She advised me, I was not on TikTok at the time, she advised that we really needed to be leveraging that platform for marketing. She did not want to be in content and I love to talk. So she said, you go get in front of the camera, you make TikToks, which is how it started. My TikTok was a vintage business TikTok. Tried to make cheeky little ads that people make. I was not good at that at all. She was like, you kind of have taken over this channel. A lot of people ask questions about your closet and your style. What if you just renamed it to Pig Mommy and then made videos for fun about sort of our life here in your closet? I said, okay. That just was slowly taking off as I was working my 9-to-5. I sort of always wanted to work in fashion when I was little. You have the hindsight's 2020 thing where you look back on things you love when you were a kid and you're like, yeah, this tracks, that it all came together later. I think I've sort of always wanted to work in personal styling but rejected that idea because I have parents that work in government. I grew up outside of DC. I have a degree in kinesiology and public health, and I just thought, well, this is what I should be doing, is working in this. But I was terrible at that job, frankly. And so personal styling just sort of took off through the lens of TikTok. And then once I moved to New York just a few months ago, that was when I was actually able to express that job in a more real, can't think of a better word for it, in a more real way where I could actually interface with clients.
I think you make a lot of really, really interesting content on kind of the concept of style and the way that we've sort of really kind of heavily coupled it up with consumption and with it being something you can buy. And we've done videos, for example, on the channel about this kind of obsession with old money style, with the sort of superficial aesthetic markers of, you know, privilege and affluence and all of these things. And we've sort of criticized it from a more sort of class perspective and how, frankly, inaccurate a lot of it is, but also this weird sort of the idea that style is a sort of specific template that you can opt into and to some extent purchase. And a lot of your content is about thinking about style totally outside of that. So I'd love to just kind of start with your view on what style really is to you and how, you know, these sort of trends that we're seeing either are part of style or perhaps not at all.
Yeah. Well, I guess first I should state the obvious, which is that I think my commentary will be sort of loaded with hypocrisy and contradiction because I work in personal styling and I work in content. I live in excess. I have a lot of stuff, but hopefully we can talk about the theory of it all and in practice for people in a way that I help my clients that may not always translate to my own behavior because of the work that I do. But I think, I guess just growing up, I realized that I used to think of style, like you said, as something that would be purchased up front. And then once you have this sort of aesthetic, everything else falls into place, especially because I grew up around very affluent communities in DC, seeing people live a certain way aesthetically and the clothes that other kids at my school had. I was not living in poverty by any means, but just sort of the brandedness of it all, the Abercrombie and the Hollister and what you had meant something. That's what I thought that style was. And so growing up, I always really wanted to acquire things. Mm-hmm. And I thought of the things as being the impetus for style versus style actually sort of being the end result of your circumstances and where you live and the weather and your art influences and your interests and something that actually comes much later. And I think that we think of style as like the purchase happens first and then everything else happens after the purchase.
Totally.
And I've learned in my journey working in style and just developing my own personal style that it's more that there's browsing and there's buying and then there's like 25 steps in between, and we kind of omit all of those and just buy things up front and then have to deal with all the consequences and the regret and the confusion and the trend whiplash later.
Sure. Well, and you are a vintage reseller, mm-hmm. notably. And you know, part of when we talk about sort of moving people toward a more, even just frankly, from a sustainability and financially sort of solvent way to approach creating a wardrobe, or really to buy anything, because this applies to basically any consumer product you can have, moving toward a model of not conflating new with better. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you specifically got into thrifting, understanding vintage shopping, and kind of how it fits into your overall idea of style?
Yeah, so I grew up, my parents are Midwestern, and I love their frugal tendencies. I grew up in a family that loves to thrift, go to auctions, estate sales. That's something that my mom and I would always do for fun together. And so I always saw value in having things that were older just because they were more unique. It was also always a better deal just to get things at the thrift store. When I was in high school and I only had babysitting income, the first thing that my friends and I would do when I could drive was go to the thrift store and get like a weird paper mache cat and a bobblehead. And that was hilarious. And it was funny to get all these quirky t-shirts versus going to the mall, maybe I didn't have any money to buy a $40 shirt at Abercrombie, so that just wasn't in the cards. So we would just, you know, mess around and get a Slurpee and go home. That was our way of acquiring things. And then it just so happened that I would go to school. Kids would ask about things that we had that were interesting. My friend and I did at one time, it's like our version of a lemonade stand. We used to go to school in the Tumblr era, and kids would pay us to cut their jeans off into shorts like dye them and bleach them. And that was sort of a fun project. And I think that's sort of also culturally or like societally when people started to gain an appreciation, like the YouTube DIY era, all the tie-dye shorts, if you kind of remember that. Renaissance on Tumblr, the studding, like yes. All of that.
Unfortunately, I was there.
Yeah, I think that people kind of started to move into that appreciation. And then it's been interesting on TikTok seeing a lot of creators talk about fashion history, because I think sometimes as new generations grow up, we don't have the context for what other people used to wear or what used to be cool, especially if you're working a 9-to-5 you know, you have better things to do than be researching the origin of this belt. You're probably just working your job and then going to Target, buying the belt that you need and coming home. So seeing creators sort of make it more accessible and entertaining for people to see, oh, you know, this thing that this fast fashion company is making was actually something that was really cool in the 80s. And if you just do a simple search on eBay, you can find one that's the same price, that's more unique, it's higher quality, it's well-worn, and it's interesting. And that kind of gets into like over individualism a little bit with style too, which I guess we could talk about later. But it's just cool to, I guess, see people have reference points for fashion that are not so gatekept only by having an industry level understanding.
Right.
I also get people very kindly are often like, oh, you're a fashion creator. You know so much about fashion. I really know nothing about capital F fashion. Could not tell you. I have some designers that I love, but I couldn't tell you the difference between last season's Mugler, whatever, or Unpack the Met themes. I'm more into just people's style and how it affects their day-to-day and self-expression sort of thing.
Do you know the creator Relax It's Just Fashion?
Yes.
And It's Only Fashion? I f***ing love that guy.
I love his content
so much. I love his content.
So relaxing.
Horrible, I don't even know his name. Do you know his name?
I have no idea.
I have no idea.
But that's common online, yeah. I feel like.
It's just Relax It's Just world. Fashion. And he, like, does these little recaps where I truly, like, he does these recaps of, like, fashion shows or, like, things that are going on in fashion. I know less than nothing, all these names meaningless to me, but I just like could sit there and watch him for 30 minutes straight. He does these little, because it's so like to think that it's this whole sort of language, yeah, and this whole, you know, matrix of context that certain people have such a heightened awareness of, like when he'll be able to reference like this looks like that and whatever. It's so fascinating to me. I'm truly head empty, no thoughts about all of it, but I love watching it.
Yeah, me too. I feel the same way about, he is also friends with Old Loser in Brooklyn, Mandy, if you're familiar with her content. She lives in Brooklyn.
Wait, is that the woman who, like, she talks a lot about, like, she's a recovered alcoholic, she, like, lived a really crazy life in L.A. and New York?
No. At least I don't think so.
She's the one maybe who gets I don't dressed know as in much all of about her videos?
No. What? Mandy does, like, Met recaps every year. Oh. Is her Met, the Met Gala is, like, her Olympics, and she does these whole series unpacking everything. She does those videos about like the renaissance of indie sleeves, and we'll kind of go through all the styles that are coming back and talk about, she's a trend forecaster.
Okay, got it. The woman I'm talking about, she's like not a fashion person per se, but she, like, all of her videos are her narrating over her getting dressed. She's in like her early 60s. She'll like start in her underwear and she gets dressed and she has really cool style.
Yeah.
But she like talks a lot about like her life and, you know, all of the crazy stuff she's done.
Oh, that's so cool. I love trying to describe, it's like trying to describe a meme to someone when you're saying, oh, have you, you know the meme where it's a photo of a dog and it's just never the same.
No.
You need to just find the user.
You just need to find it. You would love her. I'm going to send you her account.
Yeah, please do.
She's wonderful. So speaking of social media though, so like for me, like you obviously have more of an acute interest in, you know, personal style from like a clothing perspective. For me, the kind of stuff that I consume and that I'm very interested in and I do a lot of is home styling. I really like it. And I really, you know, I personally, I go in and out with finding a balance between inspiration and sort of putting yourself on a hamster wheel of inadequacy, yes, which I think is like, for me, a very fine line. Like I'm doing a little renovation thing right now. So I'm like, give it all to me. Like, I want to see all of the content.
The glass bar cabinet.
Like, what?
Oh, yeah. The glass bar cabinet.
Have you seen the wallpaper I got?
Yes, that you're going to scale down.
Oh, my God,
yes. I know too much.
Oh,
and all the Instagram stories.
Okay, this wallpaper, though, well, I'll show a picture of it or something as soon as I have it. But this wallpaper, I about lost my mind when I found it. Anyway, suffice to say, like, because I'm working on something, I sort of am allowing myself to consume a lot more visually than I normally do. But then I'll often go through phases where all of a sudden I realize that what I'm looking at on my screen is making my life feel so much worse. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, my taste or my desires are so outpacing my ability or what I have. Can you talk a little bit about how you mitigate that?
Yeah, I think, well, I've made a few videos about this. It's interesting, I guess, because a lot of the requests that I get on social media will be, can you style XYZ? And it'll be, you know, a long skirt or something. And I've realized that hard as I might, I have not been able to get myself to make that content as much as I make what I call like shopping mantras or style mantras. And these are more like mental frameworks that I use when buying things. Cause I think that sometimes we see all this content online, like you said, for home inspiration, that's very style centric. And when you see something, a product, especially when it might be the same product that many influencers are paid to promote at the same time, you know, when you see a campaign go live and you're like, ah, oh, yes, they're all, you know, eight of the same sort of product centered video.
Sure.
I have noticed that it sparks the same sort of desire in me to think that I need that thing, either because of the bias of just seeing it everywhere or because I see it styled so many ways that I think, well, I should probably have that thing and be useful for styling. So what I've realized and what's helped me mitigate that is sort of making style mantras for myself. One that I love to say and that I've said often recently is, just because I admire something doesn't mean I need to own it. Mm. And I've sort of moved into, I probably did not make that up. I'm sure somebody else in history has put those words together at some point. But I've realized the same way that I've never gone into a museum and thought, I need to steal the Mona Lisa because I like to look at it so much.
I have. I have it.
And it's in Chelsea's house.
It's in my house.
The special project in question.
I pulled off a heist.
Pulling the biggest heist of all time. I am reading The Art Thief right now, so I'm also the art heist mindset. I think that we have, and I have absolutely fallen prey to this in my style journey that I sort of mentioned, is that there's sort of this aura of entitlement and a feeling that it's a moral high ground, or there's a moral value to being able to own your style to express it. And if you're not expressing your style through ownership, then you don't have style. And you'll see this discourse a lot online too, with people saying, well, you don't even own these expensive shoes, so how can you be part of this fashion discussion, or how can you be commenting on that when you don't even have the money to participate? And I think that
hating from outside the club,
my sense of style, thinking about building my personal style, again, was very wrapped up in acquiring and thinking that if I didn't own something, that meant that I didn't have that style, which is just a really silly way to operate when you think about all the other things. Like, you could have read a book without owning it and you still have that knowledge, the same way that, not to get into some sort of woo-woo thing that if we're all naked, like, who are we really if we don't have the material ways to express ourselves? But it kind of does make you think about, like, why do I need to own these things so badly? And I've thought about that too a lot with shopping, thinking about sometimes my desire to own something can be just as informative, or rather more informative, than the process of buying it and then wearing it. Totally. Sometimes the things that I desire just says a lot about the season that I'm in, or what inspires me independent of needing to own it, and just thinking about different ways to style things that then comes from that, versus, again, purchasing something first then having everything come after. I don't know if that answered your question.
I think it totally does. And also, like, part of why I, like, ride so hard on TikTok especially, well, and Instagram too, about how, like, poorly disclosed all of the ads are on those platforms. Like, because it's so important to remember, like, using home decor as an example, part of the reason why I very frequently will go through and unfollow anyone or anything that is not, like, an actual interior designer or an actual, like, interior design publication, because anyone who is just sort of representing their own home in their life, unless they are, and this does happen sometimes, unless they're very much going out of their way to only have things that they purchased, which does exist, right? Chances are those people in their home throughout the course of creating content and getting a following and what have you, like, a lot of that stuff was gifted over time. A lot of it was part of a sponsored campaign. A lot of it was, you know, quid pro quo, what have you. And maybe they disclosed it once, but they're not disclosing it every time you see it.
Yeah, the in perpetuity. And I forget to do that as a creator as well.
Totally. And it's also, I mean, once you start to see how it sort of builds up in a person's life, on their bodies, in their homes, in everything they have, like, very quickly, what you're looking at is not actually a representation of their own finances, of what they necessarily would have even chosen to purchase if they had to purchase it themselves. And I think that is, aside from the fact that we're able to see so many people's lives who are in totally different socioeconomic brackets than we would ever usually be exposed to, we also have the added difficulty of not being able to parse when we see something, is this something that they even actually purchased or that they deemed worthy? You know, just because they have it doesn't mean they chose it.
100%. And I'm not one to, I need to preface this by saying, I'm not teeing this up to, you know, world's tiniest violin, the plight of the influencer. But I do think that it is interesting to think about sort of the scene in The Devil Wears Prada where Miranda Priestly is like, oh, Annie, don't you know this is all chosen for you? Like, it also makes you think about, now that I have been on the side of content creation for about a year now, where I've had a lot of things gifted to me, I do think, and it's funny today, I'm like, what if this was gifted? What if this was purchase. And I've done some videos too that people really like of that, where I get dressed with only things that I purchased, and you see how much of my jewelry disappears and how much fades away of things that people consider core tenets of my personal style, and just constantly harping on the acceleratedness at which I can reach, like, the goal of my personal style, whatever, tangent. But you think about how much was chosen for these people as well, sort of by corporations and trickles down, versus what would be curated and collected over time through only the lens of this person going out and shopping in the world And it also kind of makes you think of like, do I want that only because it is also chosen for me by a corporation, sort of like a tax pass through where it's like this person acts as a vessel to speak for the corporation to make us want things, versus did I want that because it actually speaks to this person's background, their interests, their curation.
Well, and also, again, what they would deem worthy of their own money, mm-hmm. because I think that's the bigger question is like, ultimately, when you're basing your consumer decisions off a very clear budget, even our taste becomes different, even the things that we deem worthy. And I think, again, like the question comes back to what is our taste outside of these consumer ideals?
Yeah.
Any takes?
I wasn't sure if you were finishing.
No. It's like, to me, it's like an existential question that I think about all the time.
I think so too. Yeah. Where does taste come from? And I also think this actually speaks and gets more into, I guess, a different topic of what you were saying the other day, but sort of divesting from the influencer economy. And I've sort of struggled with that too. And a reason why I wanted to move away from content as a bigger part of my income and move into personal styling and helping people. One, because I think it's difficult to provide pointed value en masse. Like, I don't know who I'm speaking to when I speak, and I'm not sure if I'm meeting people where they need to be met. So meeting with individual clients has been more helpful for that, and sort of meeting somebody where their taste is. I can only speak about my taste and sort of projecting that out to people. And the reason why I like to over explain and belabor and abuse the 10-minute feature on TikTok so much is because I really want to narrate and unpack every single one of my decisions so that people can make that decision based on a lengthy reasoning for why I did it versus just link, because it's really easy to style like the invisible client. It's really easy to just post a dress and say, oh, this is so cute. Cute for who? Do they live in Miami? Do they live in Arkansas? I love my comment section because people are so thoughtful. People will say, oh, I love this outfit on you. I could never wear that because I live in Texas and my style as a result has become more in this way just because of the warm climate that I live in. And I think that's an interesting part of taste too. I think social media kind of removes us from circumstance as well. There are lots of pragmatic ways that our style is the way that it is. Like, I don't wear stilettos every day like Carrie Bradshaw because I never take taxi cabs. I walk everywhere. I don't want to exacerbate plantar fasciitis or whatever. So you need to wear flat shoes, and that sort of just becomes part of your taste as a result of that. And I think that also is part of moving away from taste just being this aesthetic based acquisition and something that is a holistic part of our lives, the same way that the way that you sign an email is part of your style, or the way that I think of you and your style as being very, not to perceive you online, but I think of you and your style as being very sort of community oriented, if that makes sense. Like, I don't think of your style as being an aesthetic and a cardboard cutout the way that I think a lot of us think about influencers or online personas that we follow. But when I think about your style, I don't think about a paper doll cardboard cutout. I think about a lifestyle. Oh, and again, thanks. That can tip into the insidious of like, are we trying to buy this aspirational lifestyle? Are we buying this person? But when I look at you, I can see that all the aspects of your interests and your life inform your home and clothing style in a way that's very authentic and it's true to you.
Well, thank you.
And it is material. I think it is difficult to separate it. And I think a reason why I like to talk about it so much and why it is also hypocritical at a lot of times is because we also fall into the binary of being like, you either follow influencers that are very trend-centric and might be super product pushy, or as I did years ago as well, you sort of fall into minimalist content of de-influencing and rejecting purchases and divesting from owning things as being the way to develop style. But I do think that shopping ultimately still is like some part of this ecosystem. It's just like, how do we minimize it and use it thoughtfully? And I feel like that's kind of a missing, I don't want to say niche, word is overused, but it's a missing part of this binary that I think a lot of people are trapped in, because they're like, okay, well, I still do want to shop. I still want to develop my personal style, but not so far to the point that we're just mindlessly buying links and buying to buy.
100%. Well, I think for me anyway, and part of the reason why I'm so aggressive about being open about my finances and about having a hard rule that like, if you see it on my accounts, I bought it, like, is because I do think often there's never a concept of enough when it comes to consumption. There's very rarely a concept of, and it, for me, I do sometimes feel frustrated when I look at other content creators that have, you know, a massive platform, have a lot of influence, really impact people's perception. And I know that they have plenty of effing money and they could buy things. And if they wanted something, they could buy it. If something was meaningful enough to them, they could make room in their budget for it. But, you know, they choose to accept a lot of gifts, to, you know, have an even more artificially inflated lifestyle, to be dishonest about their finances in both passive and active ways. And I think the problem is, if you don't have a concept of, okay, and it's different for everyone, and I always want to stress, like, I know that a lot of the people who are in a similar space to me industry-wise, like, this is their only source of income. You know, they might have kids. They might not be in a dual-income household. They might be in a financially different position than myself. So I'm not trying to insist that it's, like, one specific level for everyone. But I do think for a lot of creators that I follow, like, especially when it comes to, like, the TikTok shop, the merch, the affiliate stuff, like, it just feels like there's never a concept of, okay, I wanted a certain lifestyle, I have it, now I'm going to stop constantly growing and pursuing more and expanding. And to me, I think, like, as a business owner, for example, when we look at what are the imperatives of capitalism, it's perpetual growth, right? It's like you always must be doing better this quarter than the previous quarter. And I think for a lot of people, it's really difficult for them to not let that infect their own personal perception of their own finances and of their own consumer habits. And that, I think, is a huge missing part, is that I rarely see people make a decision. And I do sometimes, and I want to shout that out, is that I do sometimes, but not that often do I see people say, like, actually, I'm good. I don't need more money. I don't need more stuff.
You know? So funny that you said that. It's actually not funny. It's very, like, wah-wah, but it's very true and pointed that you said that, because I actually was just having a conversation with my roommate a few weeks ago that I was like, I don't want to grow anymore. I was like, I wish that things could just stay the way that they were. And I think that it's a difficult, which is insane and perhaps also a very privileged thing to say, but it's just nice to be able to nurture something. And I think another thing that stops personal style is this constant growth, because it makes us seek breadth instead of depth in our style. And the same way, I talked once about a metaphor of sort of like treating your closet like a friend group or a social ecosystem. And if you're constantly only hanging out with people in social settings where you meet them once, you're developing a lot of acquaintances, you're sort of going to parties, I think of that as like fast fashion. Like, you're never really hanging out with people, you're never outfit repeating, you're never learning getting inside jokes with your clothing and learning it and seeing it in different environments. You know how you feel differently when you meet a friend? It's different if you only met them at the bar, but then you invite them over for dinner and it's sort of a new development in your relationship. That's sort of how I think about building your style and outfit repeating. And I think that there's kind of a shallowness to it as well. Like, this constant growth, it's expanding and it's expanding, it's expanding, but you're never like tending to the garden, so to speak. It's almost like if you had a garden and you just planted soil in limitless miles and then never came back to water it and till it and nurture the plants. And I have also been very stressed in having it in an income to reach a point where it's like, okay, I do have enough. I also get a lot of comments, and it's weird to feel like you need to train your audience also to not expect that from you, because in sort of an absence of purchasing in the content creator context, because it still is very much purchasing in a normal person's context, but in the absence of sort of new pieces or new styling videos, I do get a lot of comments like, what are you shopping for? What's on your wish list? And I was like, nothing. I just am enjoying actually using what I have and styling my clothes, and I don't want anything right now. But then you do get these gifts unsolicitedly, and you do have these partnerships where you're talking about products and companies really do not like. I have learned when I've styled pieces that are really pieces that, as I said before, are sort of circular. I just got this great aviator jacket gifted from Banana Republic, and somebody asked where it was from, and I said, well, Banana Republic sent it, but you can find this exact style on eBay for like $200, and I posted a used one on my Instagram story. And it's a weird place to be in, to want to have the resources to try things for my clients and to perpetuate my living as it stands right now in this circumstance, but also say to people, you know, you don't really need to buy this. And then the companies are like, what? That's what we were paying you to do. So it's kind of this, like you said, just the exhausting nature of the constant growth and expansion and new, when a lot of this already exists, and it's sort of just honing taste, reimagining things, exercises in self-discovery.
So let's talk about how the internet can be a scary place to share personal information about yourself, something that I know very well. I recently discovered, for example, how easy it is to get your accounts hacked. I, for those who don't know, had my Twitter account hacked back in late September. And after over 100 attempts with their support team, I was unable to get it back until a personal friend of mine who happened to have a connection at one of the employees there was able to help me retrieve it. But during that month where my account was literally taken over over by a crypto scam. It was incredibly stressful. And of course, like the first thing I did was like go and change all my other passwords and make sure nothing was connected. But it really did make me feel incredibly vulnerable. And I have personally been using DeleteMe for months now. And the feeling that you get from seeing just how visible a lot of your personal information was when you get your reports was really eye-opening. We're talking like name, address, phone number, stuff that's even more sensitive than some of the things that were on my Twitter, to be perfectly honest.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And it is very easy for people to get access to your data, extremely personal data. It's probably available to anyone who's ready to pay for it right now. And not to cause panic, but this is something we need to think about. Sadly, there are companies out there called data brokers whose entire job is to collect huge amounts of your personal info, like your name, address, phone number, social security number, and even information about your relatives. This information is then sold online, which is kind of insane. But the good news is that DeleteMe can help you, like it helped me. DeleteMe protects your data from data brokers by reducing the risks of identity theft, scams, and those annoying spam calls and emails we all get. Their software and team of experts will not just find and remove your personal information from hundreds of data broker websites, but they'll continuously scan for new data that shows up and get that removed as well. Instead of you spending hours of your time figuring out how to remove this data, DeleteMe does it for you. Before you go into a panic, take control of your data by signing up for DeleteMe. It's super easy to use and it actually works. And they offer a special discount to our listeners. Get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and use promo code TFC. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and enter promo code TFC at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/TFC, promo code TFC.
Well, and also kind of determining what actually adds real meaning or value or joy to your life versus what, you know, maybe has like a flash of like acquisition or, you know, a sense of completion or satisfaction when we make a purchase. You know, like, for example, we talked about earlier, I'm doing this renovation in my home and I've done a few now. And these are things that are, they're fair amounts. They're an investment. Like I'll probably on this particular renovation all in, I'll probably spend somewhere around $8,000. Now, I should be clear that in the case of home renovation as a homeowner, I do view that as an investment. I think it will add substantially to the value of the home. And, you know, we were lucky enough to buy the home when it was very low compared to market value due to COVID. We have an insanely low interest rate on our mortgage. So like, I do feel more able to justify that purchase to myself from a, you know, a more sort of business-oriented perspective in terms of long-term value. However, that being said, like what's undeniable is that I can think of 100 things off the top of my head that I could also spend that amount of money on. And I think we all have, in big and small ways, these purchases that, you know, are not totally necessary. And it's up to us to find an internal sort of homing device about where the money is best spent. And for me, it took a very long time to determine, like, I could buy a whole new wardrobe, I could buy, you know, a fabulous trip, I could buy all of these things. It happens that this is the kind of thing that really gives me a lot of internal value for that money. But I think for a long time, for many years, again, especially I think due to consuming so much social media content, I genuinely did not know what purchases were meaningful to me versus which ones had the appearance of value.
I had the same similar experience. And I also think this also sort of gets into like the aesthetic versus the lifestyle. And the reason why I perceive you so much as a real person with a lifestyle that is,
it's like my mom.
Fully aligned.
All these compliments.
And you're so pretty, Chelsea.
Look at this.
But I think that there's also this sort of dystopian way that we consume things now where you can acquire the appearances of a lifestyle without acquiring the lifestyle. Like, especially with all these trends, you know, tomato girl ballerina summer or whatever it's called.
What the fuck is that?
I don't know, but I see these words every day. All, every day my friend and I
tomato
are like,
tomato girl ballerina summer.
None of these words are in the Bible. Like, I don't know where, I don't know where they come up with this stuff. But
I'm a zucchini girl.
Such a zucchini girl. I'm such an onion tall boot lady. And it is weird to think, I had to have a conversation with myself where I'm like, okay, you love to dress like an art dealer, but when's the last time you've been to a museum? Like, this is so dystopian. Ooh, that you
drag yourself.
Yeah, just dragging myself over the coals every day. Because it really is disturbing to think about the ways that, and I know we joke and it's all in good fun, about, you know, I'd rather be sad at home in my Dior shoes than actually be able to go to Paris or whatever and window shop maybe at the Dior store. And there are kind of all those tweets and memes about, like, Carrie, you know, I have all these shoes and no house. And we joke about that and we glamorize it, but it is kind of weird to think, what is it worth to have this aesthetic if I can't actually back it with a lifestyle that is also meaningful, that sort of folds nicely into that aesthetic? And I used to also buy a lot of clothes that were aspirational, thinking again that purchasing is the first step, and then once I buy a fancy dress, I would be then invited to fancy parties, or that I have somewhere to wear the fancy dress. And now, living in New York, it is such that I actually do get to go to some fun parties in the city and wear the fancy dress. But I know,
I have a cool girl on her hands.
Cool onion tomato girl in her fancy dress out in the town.
Like, yeah, a little Ratatouille energy with the tomato, the onion, the zucchini.
I know. But it's weird to think that I spent a lot of time in sort of the early days when I first had an income buying all these things that I had nowhere to wear them to, because I was obsessed with the aesthetic and putting on the appearances of having a certain sort of lifestyle, but I wasn't really doing anything. Not to say that my life was meaningless, but just I've been much more intentional now about A, weighing a purchase against an experience that I could have, which I feel like is trite, but when you view it through the lens of, is my aesthetic in line with my lifestyle, it doesn't sound so sort of beat to hell. I don't know if I should curse.
No, I think that's, I said
yeah.
Sorry, Emily, you're gonna have to be.
Do you know what I mean, though?
No,
sort of
100%.
A lot of these, I think it's difficult because there are so many of these sort of minimalist and de-influencing tropes that we hear over and over again, that they sort of fall into cliches, that it's like, yeah, yeah, we all should consume yet less. Yeah, yeah, sustainability. Yeah, yeah, de-influencing. And even when I make sort of these videos, I get a bunch of comments being like, we don't need more stuff, clap emoji, de-influencing. And I do think it is in a way de-influencing, but it's different than just saying, let's buy less. Because it's very easy to say, but it's difficult to unpack what we are buying less of,
exactly.
What we still actually do want to be purchasing. I think I remember you telling the story about that Robin's Egg coat that was like a terrible...
Oh my God. Literally a core foundational element of the TFD canon, my Robin's Egg blue fox fur coat.
Yes.
And I'll never get over this. The person in the comments was like, it's pronounced faux. I'm like, you motherfucker, how dare you come into my house and pretend like I don't know how the word faux is pronounced. It's from a literal fox. Of course, I would not buy that today. It was like a whole thing. But I, you know, at the time, to your point, like I had a feeling of like there was a whole life that went along with that coat. And there was also such a feeling of success to have been able to purchase it. And, you know, I at least should have had the foresight to purchase something a bit more evergreen. But I do think that there is just that feeling of, like you said, wanting objects sort of almost like artifacts of a life that is not yours and perhaps in many ways not even particularly flattering. Like I went to a like cool restaurant recently that I didn't realize was cool until I got there. And like it was one of those things where like I was like at a table with my husband and our friend. And I was like in the booth so I could see out to the whole like sort of dining room. And I just sort of scanned the room and every woman in there was like, I would say like late 20s to late 30s, maybe a little earlier, maybe mid 20s to mid 30s, let's say. Every last one of them almost had like hair.
Slick back bun. I knew you were going to say that.
Slick back bun, center part, like dead slicked to their heads, you know, like with like Elmer's glue or whatever,
yeah.
Like in a tiny little knot at the very base of their heads. Very similar outfits, but I just remember that hairstyle. And I was like, I'm against filming people in public, so I did not do that. But in my mind, I was like, remember this, because I, listen, more power to them, but that is a tough hairstyle for a lot of head shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these women.
Mine included.
Like,
if you see me in a slick back bun, call for help, because I'm distressed.
Like,
I'm having a psychotic break.
It
looks so good on some people.
Not on everyone. In fact, I would say not on the majority. It's not a particularly flattering hairstyle. And also, like, if you don't have a ton of hair, That little bun, like, it looks like, I don't know, it looked like a little, like a cheese ball or something. Like, it was just so small. Anyway, yeah. Suffice to say, I was like, how did we get here, guys? How did we get here that we're all, like, participating in this very specific aesthetic, because the clothes kind of went along with, that is so deeply unflattering to most people, that I would imagine is not a style that we would have independently chosen.
No, 100%.
And yet the whole restaurant was nothing but that.
It's really strange. It makes me think of, I'm going to go on a whole other tangent and reference my own videos, like the hubristic influencer that I am.
I watch the hell out of them, so.
But it makes me think about I made this video basically about trends and how it is my style opinion now that I've sort of worked on my personal style that I realize that everybody gets a turn. And I think that a lot of us are sort of afraid to age in style because we don't want to be stopped at a point in time where people look at us. And I've had people make comments being like, well, your ripped jeans are so 2010. But I love that. And that makes me happy because that is the time that I remember getting into Tumblr and everything and sort of first caring about style and developing it. And when I think about people's closet tours of style icons, like you go into... Just a quick example, because I've watched this video 1,001 times, not to fall into the kryptonite trap of a thin white woman with perfectly wavy hair, but Camille Rowe and her Vogue Closet series. I know, drag me.
Not a Parisian girl.
I know. No, I should be shamed for that. But
no, it's fine.
I've seen the video 1,000 times.
You're allowed to enjoy it.
As a treat.
You can have a little, basic Parisian girl as a treat. I can fawn over a
thin white Parisian woman for 5 minutes as a treat. And her closet is amazing, not because it was all purchased in one season in, you know, this haul, but because it's kind of cut into like a tree ring, and you can see all the places that she's been and all the versions of herself that she's been and all these things that she's had over time. Granted, I have no idea what of this was gifted. It was a Vogue, you know, whatever. But
we'll get into that.
We'll get into that. But in an idealized world, and a lot of her items are also vintage, the message still stands the same, that it's kind of nice to look in someone's closet and think, oh, you know, this cool archival coat, not that it's cool because it's archival Jean-Paul Gaultier, but it's archival you. Like,
yeah.
What version of your past self do you still hold on to? And another style exercise I like to do is looking at kid photos of what I liked and being like, oh, I would still wear that. Like, there are photos of me going to school on picture day. My mom wanted me to wear a dress, and I wore this sort of like Annie Hall vest with a tie, and it was polka dot, and I just thought that was so cool. And I still think that's so cool. It's very sort of like smart, British, preppy crossover, and that's kind of how a lot of my adult style is as well. And I think that it's weird that we're sort of, I made this video about how people, I think we view trends as like a bus, and the bus comes to the station with the new trends and you have to get on and ride, but it's more like a sushi conveyor belt where, like, let everything pass in front of you. You're sitting and eating and just take what you want and sort of add it to your plate. And then the plate becomes this nice diversified, you know, you go to a sushi bar, everyone has the same menu, but your plate might look different than the person you're dining with. And that's cool to see how you take things and put them together versus just dumping and constantly all riding the same bus in circles where, you know, I think back,
That video was a bop, by the way.
Thank you. I'm just like launching tip after tip in this little rant. But the next tip that I'll tack onto that, that also plays into this, is that I've started to keep not a wish list, but a desire archive. So anytime I desire something, anytime I have a want for something, I think I want to buy it. In person, I don't do this as much, but especially with online shopping and linking, because I'm also easily influenced by other people, I take note of it. And it is humiliating, disturbing to look at the length of this archive and how many things I have a want for, how many things I desire, that 6 months later I don't even think about. And again, it sounds like that trite point of, you know, wait 2 weeks and if you still want it, then you can buy it. And I think we hear that advice so often that it's just like, ugh, that's so obvious. But I have one for the entire year. Every year when I go back and I think, you know, this December I really want a certain bag, or you're so obsessed with something and you think that that thing will be what pushes you over into having personal style or having your home completed, I look at this archive and laugh thinking, you know, I thought all of this 1 year ago was so important and that that would be the thing that would fix my style, or that would be the thing that would fix my home. And I didn't buy it and everything's fine. And if I still want it, thanks to the bustling online secondhand economy, I can probably still go find it secondhand for a better deal, participate in the circular economy, whatever. It's a separate discussion. But just thinking about sort of like the wanting and the passing, and especially with the slick back bun thing, I remember in like 2021, everyone was talking about how the Aritzia Molina pant, those leather pants, were like the best closet staple. And it's like a, maybe
I have no
it's,
idea what that is.
God bless. But it's thinking about sort of these trends that, especially in the lens of basic and sort of timelessness and like basics and capsule wardrobes and that sort of style, a lot of things are touted as being like the one thing that you need, or like the slick back bun is touted as like the easiest hairstyle to have. That's just no fuss, like forever. So timeless, so chic. And it's every time we buy into this too much, it becomes like too much of a point in time that you then look back a year later and you're like, that's hilarious that I thought that was so
necessary. It's like the 2017 sleeves. Yeah. Clock those a million
miles. The cold shoulders and the bell sleeves.
What was happening?
And it's not even like the rejection of trends, I think, because then that kind of moves into the space of like, don't buy into trends, which is another trite and very confusing piece of advice that's like, do buy into trends thoughtfully and then just embrace that you like those trends and try to find something, try to get to a point where you don't care if something is passe and that you just still like it. Like, I love dressing like I'm stuck in 2014. And I think that I'm just always going to love that.
I would actually say, and I think we can each have our own approach, but I think it's totally fine to like, don't even pay attention. Like be like, it's totally fine to be totally unaware of trends.
I think that too. Yeah.
Like as I talk about a lot, I almost exclusively follow women over 50.
I love that video.
An exception here. but I mean, for the most part, they are not dressing in what I would consider to be a trendy way. And I don't really have sources. Like, I feel like, for example, that pant you mentioned, no f-ing clue what that is. Had never heard of it before. The slick back bun, until I saw a group of, 50 different women in a restaurant all having it at the same time, I wasn't even aware that that was like a thing. And I think that's okay too, because it, sometimes you will arrive at things almost from first principles. And if you go to a store in a given year, you're going to see what's trendy sort of just by what's on display. But I think it's okay to release yourself from the burden of feeling like you have to know. Oh, like 100%. I would never know that you would consider yourself as dressing like 2014, because I don't really feel like I know what 2014 looks like.
Yeah. That might be my chronically online Gen Z everything showing. And people are like, everyone's wearing this. And it's like, who is everyone? Have you been outside?
Who I haven't is seen everyone wearing that. No one wears that stuff. Well, and also I do think when you primarily consume all this stuff through the internet, you're already playing to such a small audience and you're already swimming in such a narrow circle. Whereas the vast majority of people that you're going to meet in real life, they have no f-ing clue what we're talking about. Like, this is not relevant in any major way, except again, once they log onto their screens. But I had such a visceral reaction to Camille Rao because as I've discussed before, and it brings me to the point I wanted to address with you, which is, part of the reason that I feel like I've never been able to even take a real interest in clothing style the way I have in home style is because so much of it is wrapped up in being thin.
Yeah.
And listen, this could be my PTSD from the amount of time in my life I have spent with French boomers and French people generally, and the just war zone of body negativity that it is over there. And so much of like the French girl style stuff is so much about being thin.
Yes.
And obviously white and rich and all of these other things, and also a very specific aesthetic and young. Although I will say, I do think they have a slightly better relationship to ageism than we do in the US. And like, it's very common to see women on television who are much older with wrinkles,
they're more of an aging gracefully mentality. But I just meant generally people are also obsessed with youth.
Like the one, like if you're going to see like in like an aesthetic video, a French girl style, she's generally going to be quite young. Mm-hmm. You're not looking at, an Estée Lafrissange or whatever, although you should be. So for me, it's like obviously the most cliched sort of approach to that is like, is it style or is she just thin? Mm-hmm. Which I think is a real question to ask ourselves about many people. But for you anyway, how do you decouple your idea of personal style from thinness?
It is in content. It's weird because it's like you have to decide sort of video by video. It's like, is this a narration of my own life in which I do play the character and am a thin white woman? Or is it a video that is supposed to be valuable and helpful to others? Because I think those are sort of two different lenses that I have to decide per video where I'm going. Like if I'm narrating my own outfit, I might not speak to that as much just because it's a narration of this is what I'm wearing today. But then when I'm making advice videos, when I'm styling clients, that's when it really comes in that you have considerations. And another reason why I wanted to move more towards personal styling is because then it's not, the me show of what I know to be true and what exists in my realm of personal style, but also helping other people work sort of through style therapy of, I do get a lot of questions about why I can't wear this because I look a certain way, or I can't wear this because it's too young or too old for me, and sort of attacking that fat phobia and that ageism through those lenses too, of helping people individually with their personal style. But I think sort of what I said earlier, it's difficult en masse to know who I'm even speaking to or who's sort of asking questions in my videos about those sort of things, if that makes sense.
Totally. Totally. And also, I don't know. It's very like part of the reason that I do try to go out of my way to skew the ages of who I follow and algorithmically just like kind of generate that vibe is because, you know, unfortunately for a lot of social platforms, and again, especially if you're looking in the space of style, influencing, consumerism, all of those kinds of things, inevitably, if you just let the algorithm do its thing, you're going to be targeted with a bunch of 23-year-olds who just generally, sort of by grace of their youthful metabolism, are probably going to be quite trim. And you're also going to be exposed to a kind of style where, you know, there is a permissiveness. And I think that's something else that we give to thin bodies. Like, the crazy, crazy stuff you can wear and have it be perceived as fashionable, or, you know, the trends that you can experiment with, and the sort of, even like the architectural shapes, you know, if you're a woman, for example, who is bigger, let's say, you have probably been raised with an ironclad edict to flatter yourself.
Yes, and those god-awful pear, whatever, the fruit assortment of shapes that we're meant to identify as.
And like, you have like certain parts you cover and certain parts you highlight. And there's a very sort of like strict sense of what you're allowed to wear. Whereas with thinness, there's often such an experimental nature. And I think that is also very tied up with youth. We allow much more grace to experiment with youth. To what extent do you feel like the thinness thing is just about thinness, and how much of it is also youth culture, especially on social media?
Yeah, well, I think, I guess, two separate points to that. One, the thinness thing. This is actually a good point to bring up an idea that's been living in drafts purgatory for a long time that I've been meaning to make.
Writing the advanced copy.
Advanced copy, yeah. Author's edition with editor's notes, which is just Kelsey and I saying and giggling at each other. I think that flattery is a tricky word, because I don't think that it's... I guess the video that I've been wanting to make that I've been stewing on for a while is sort of like, I think flattery can be just one part of a toolbox of fashion, and then it's just one way that you can decide to look one day, whatever that means to you. There are outfits, for whatever reason, that I like my body more or less in, but I don't take that as seriously as I used to when I was younger. I used to think that everything first had to be flattering, and then from then I could experiment in my style. Even somebody who is thin and white and privileged and everything else, that was still something that was like top of mind for me. And so now I think about it more. And Mandy, Old Loser in Brooklyn, made a great video about this as well. So people comment on her videos, oh, that isn't flattering, that isn't flattering. She's like, well, that's just not something I think about when I get dressed. Like, that's not an adjective in my repertoire. And for some people, that is sort of a tenet of their personal style, is to be flattered first and then everything else comes after. And I think you sort of have to make a conscious decision that, no, I am going to play with silhouettes. I am going to allow myself to experiment. I am going to do things with my style that may not be considered flattering, and that doesn't really matter. It's more important to be, what's the saying? It's like, I'd rather be cool than hot. Like, just, it's more important to focus on other things. So I guess that would be my note on that, sort of that I don't think it's evil to want to, you know, tailor your clothes. And I think that I would be remiss, especially when working with clients, when they have a goal to present a certain way, not necessarily through the lens of thinness, but they're just like, I don't know why I don't like these clothes on myself. And sometimes it is a longer conversation that needs to be had about sort of self-acceptance and moving towards that place of body neutrality or body positivity. But then sometimes it's also just like, oh, I don't think that you like a drop shoulder on yourself. I think you like a more tailored silhouette. And some people might label that as flattery, but it's also just sort of like playing with silhouettes. And it's a tricky thing to move, it's a tricky thing to orbit around, because you sort of always have to go down every rabbit hole of like, what was the impetus for me thinking this thing about
myself?
Is this
like my mom in my head or
exactly,
whatever?
Exactly, yeah. Is it like the almond, is it the almond mom talking to me, or is it that I love the way that Tom Brown makes a suit and it just so happens that those sharp lines that line up with certain points in my body is the way that the clothes are, that they're meant to be expressed?
That, I think, makes total sense. And I do need to check my own hypocrisy for saying that that little tiny slick back bun is not flattering on many heads. I should clarify, I mean, by no means does that have anything to do with weight. I think hairstyles are a very different thing when it comes to, like, what works with your head shape. But to your point, like, if people want to wear a hairstyle that doesn't necessarily, like, lean into their head shape, they should also be allowed to do that.
It's like more
PG, yeah. It's just more a question of like, with that particular thing, it's like you can see the influence of a trend that has gravitated people toward a center that is not their own.
Oh, 100%.
Because statistically, it's impossible that you all just independently want that.
Yeah.
But to the youth thing.
Yeah, the youth thing, I would say, just sort of goes back to what I was saying before about personal style, that I think people can have an obsession with buying into trends, not only in an order to be cool, but it also, I don't know, some people are going to be like, that's a reach. But sometimes I feel like buying into trends can perpetuate ageism, because it makes us feel like in order to be relevant and worthy, we need to be the most up to date. Like, people really praise older reality TV stars and things who never seem to sort of fall into the person that they were when they started to form themselves. Like, I always joke that because I'm 26, I can feel myself cooking. I'm like, we're in the oven, we're like solidifying up here. Like, everything is sort of, you can feel tenets of your personality and your values and everything coming through the older that you get, and things that have stayed steadfast and things that have fallen away. And I think that buying into trends so much or being hyper aware of them can feel like an attempt to not age sometimes. And I don't mean that in the way that I don't think in a reverse ageism way where I'm like, older people can't wear young, trendy, hot clothes, because I think obviously you should wear what speaks to you. But sometimes this kind of race and a chase to constantly be optimizing and reinventing ourselves in order to stay cool, because you don't want to date yourself. You don't want somebody to open the fridge and say, oh, well, that's, you know, that's so the 2008 style. That's not what's up to date, when that's like really who they are, and like being self-assured as a woman and not feeling like you need to constantly reinvent yourself to be perceived as sort of young and hip and cool and on the pulse.
I think that's...
It's again, this is in drafts purgatory. I'm talking through it right now with you. But it's a weird thing to feel like, I can feel myself trying to, even as a 26-year-old, I can feel myself trying to stay 22, competing with some other creators where it's like, oh, I gotta, you know, do this, this, and that to still be perceived in this way, so that people know that I'm cool and that I'm hip and that I like know what's what. And I'm like, but that's not, A, is that important to me? And B, is that really something that is in my best interest, again, for my personal style? And like, do I want a closet that hasn't aged?
That's a race.
Because I also age. Yeah, exactly.
First of all, I clocked you as being much older in a positive way. I just thought you were like an early 30-something with excellent skincare.
That's incredible.
don't you think? She comes off as much more grounded than 26, I think, and well-spoken.
That's so
and,
kind.
You know, have a lot of interesting insights. But to your point, I think what's so weird about the sort of flattening from an age perspective, because like I'm 34, I consume you as someone 8 years younger than me on a very sort of peer-like level on the internet. And then I also consume women who are 20 plus years older than me, also on a very peer kind of level, where I feel like we're all just like having a conversation. And in some ways, I feel like for me anyway, the sort of utopian view of what social media can create from that perspective, from an ageism perspective, is making us all more aware that, you know, so much of the pressure that we put on certain age brackets is totally arbitrary, and people advance and change and evolve in totally different ways across huge swaths of their life. I mean, for example, several of the women that I follow who are in their, I'd say, you know, early 50s to early 60s, they're just starting their lives because they left a marriage, honestly, or, you know, they're recently widowed, or, you know, they're having a total renaissance and doing things that many of us might associate with 20-somethings doing, you know, going on girls trips, like having friends with benefits, like totally reinventing their style, doing all of this kind of stuff. And I think, unfortunately, like you're saying, with the feeling of like thinking sometimes and having to, you know, downplay that feeling of like needing to stay relevant or to compete with people younger, it's like, it's so easy to fall into the trap of using that proximity to different ages as a stressor rather than as a liberator.
Yeah, and as inspiration as well. I had featured you recently in my newsletter when I talked about people, and when I talk about older people to follow, it's like basically everyone, because I'm 26. So besides, you know, the Alex Earls of the world, there are just so many people that are just by definition older than me to be followed. But it is also cool to see. And something else, I guess, tying back into sort of the economics of influencing and perceiving people's content, is that we forget, when you see people that you might not know how old they are and you see their amazing homes and their amazing closets, it also maybe they probably have 20 years on you, independent of economics, that they've had time to collect all of those things.
Yes, they
and
do.
And to have shopped and to have crafted their home in such a way that they have, you know, the gorgeous painted cabinets and whatnot. Like, obviously, you don't have that. You're 21. I had roaches.
And some people, and I think that's the other thing, is wanting, I think part of what is interesting with ageism for me and like kind of rethinking age through exposure to these other lives is like, when you have all those things at a super young age, I actually think it's really terrible for you.
Yeah.
Because I think it was, who did that AD tour? It was a very young influencer.
Emma Chamberlain.
Yes. Yes. It bummed me out in a major, major way, because so much. I mean, you're looking at a home that's, you know, being profiled in Architectural Digest that has been designed within an inch of its life by some of the most prominent interior designers in the world. You know, the I'm sure
$50,000 like chandeliers. Yeah.
You know, the kitchen island alone is probably half a million of marble. And she was, what, 21 in that, 22? And for me, anyway, when I think back on what was most wonderful about being 21, 22, is making something that felt magical and special and personal with so little, and then every year getting to feel as though you live a life that is more realized, that is more rich, that is more, you know, you have something to really aspire to with each passing year, both in terms of things you might be able to afford, but also, like you said, in terms of being able to accumulate sort of the detritus of a life well lived. If you're starting out there at 21, like, where are you going, bud?
Like, I think about that all the time, too, with the need to feel complete and the need to sort of have, especially in the age of, like, home tours, closet tours, collection videos, it feels like everything is always finished for everyone. Yes. And it never is finished because we're all on this journey of constantly consuming, constantly wanting new things. And again, with the archive desire that I was talking about, I think about things I wanted 5 years ago and thought, you know, oh, well, I guess I'm 22 now. I need to start thinking about my adult wardrobe, and I have a 9-to-5, so I need to have a 9-to-5 wardrobe. And it's like, what was I trying to finish that for? Like, you can just have one suit. You're the dinky 22-year-old that's writing dumb emails. I can just poke around in one suit. No one's going to care. The next year, I'll sort of acquire something. And now we sort of acquire at such a rate that it's like a meaningless revolving door. And we don't feel the weight of the things that we acquire as much, that it's like, oh, this was so special. I remember when I got XYZ thing that I saved up so much for, or that I was so excited about, and it served as like a point in time of my taste versus just this constant accumulation. It's sort of hard to even appreciate or see anything because of the sheer volume. And that could be a privilege take also, just because of the most people reasonably and as they should do not acquire at the rate that I do because of this like weird circumstance that I'm in with content work. But
maybe not of the same quality, but I think with fast fashion and the fast fashionification of consumerism, people do acquire a lot. I mean, statistically they do. Fast furniture. But I think also that race to feel finished, like you said, in the era of the tour and the, you know, the posts and the things that feel like a display of something, like it also, and that with combined with the over accessibility of these cheap consumer goods, like, it really creates a perception that style, whether in terms of the things you wear or the home you live in or what have you, that it's a fixed thing, that it's not like you're not allowing yourself the enjoyment of all of that being a living, breathing thing that like is
it's like
always changing.
100%. Especially with all the listicles that have you seen that tweet? This might be a little too Gen Z, but I'm going to be brave and say it anyway. The tweet that's like, if you're a part-time GJ and I'm writing listicles, then who's driving this bus? Like, it's just like the listicle culture that we live in. And I also get a lot of content requests for like 5 must-have winter coats. Again, content that I'm terrible at because I'm like, I don't know what's a must-have for you. I have no idea who you are, what your budget is, where you live, if you're a teacher, if you're a bus driver, if you are the president of the United States. And I haven't even finished my own coat collection. I don't own a puffer coat. I'm on the hunt. And it's sort of a weird thing too, to feel like there's the, like I said, training your audience and the reverse pressure of also not letting the culture that we're in inform the type of content that people make. And that's why I always have to check myself and being careful, because content performs well when you're confident. And when you say, this is what I think, here are like 10 options for this. And then I always, again, abuse the 10-minute feature. And I'm like, well, there's so many more options than that. You don't really need to collect them all now. And next winter, you might feel differently and you should wait. And I've gone this long without a puffer coat. Do I even really need one now? And again, it's just that weird thing of like, why do we feel the need to have, you know, 10 closet must-haves? We've been making those lists every single year. Certainly, they aren't must-haves if we feel the need to remake the list every year, which again goes back to like, it's living, it's breathing. Are these must-haves for everyone? How are you constantly sort of iterating and reimagining? And that almost, I feel like it's more difficult to acquire the right things for us than we think it is. Like, it's made to feel so accessible and so easy to us and so overwhelming because of this paralysis of choice that these companies every week are like, 500 new arrivals. And I'm like, that's really concerning. And you're using that as a marketing tactic.
Well, and again, I think, you know, the feeling, whether it's feeling like your wardrobe is complete, or again, like for me, like I love my bathroom, but I've had like a few frames in it that are empty for going on 6 months now. And I used to like,
which is crazy because it's not even a long period of time.
Not even a long period of time.
That's like, but that, oh, this place is falling apart.
My God. I used to like older me, slightly older me, would like when I would have people over for a dinner or whatever, I would be like, "Now, just so you know, I'm aware of the empty frames in the bathroom. We're working on it as we speak."
When you're hosting them for like a lovely Chelsea Fagan style dinner party and having a good time, like,
But it, you know, and my mother, and especially my grandmother, are they have really beautiful spaces and are the type of people to, you know, be very, it's almost like the scene in 8 Mile where it's like he says all the insults about himself before the other battle rapper
can say it about him.
Like, I'm always like, I know, we're doing it. And so, like, you know, and releasing that and being like, you know what, I just haven't found things that I want for those frames. And when I come across them, I will put them in. And until then, it's totally fine that it's not finished, because even once all those frames are filled, over the years, I'm sure I'll change the things that are in them, you know?
Things about that. Sorry to cut you off.
No, please, go for it.
I was just going to say, in the same vein of like, just because I admire it doesn't mean I need to own it. I've started to think like, just because it isn't complete doesn't mean I can't be satisfied. 100%. And there are definitely things that I want on my wish list, but that isn't inhibiting me from enjoying my wardrobe now. And my dinner parties and my hangouts with friends have not suffered because I was ugly or because I was underdressed or because I was like, I've had just as rich of a life and just as good of a time with friends when I was wearing, you know, a college sweatshirt and leggings. That's not a case for necessarily, you know, again, the whole thing where it's like, style doesn't even matter. If we were all naked, we'd still love each other or whatever. But
not me. I would not love anyone.
I would not, no. I'm like, where's the coat?
Put on some clothes.
But yeah, it just makes you think about like, why do we only see the lack and not everything that we have accumulated? And not, again, the trite thing of like, practice gratitude, but it's really like, oh wow, if I look back at everything that I have acquired that I do love and that I have built and that I can enjoy versus always thinking about what I don't have or what I could be better at and watching those 80 home tours and being like, maybe I do need a $70,000 chandelier. Let me try to slave over an Etsy DIY to make some crappy thing that cost me like $1,000 that I want to throw away because I hated my house so much. Because then, I don't know if you've ever been in that space where you're like spending so much money on a crazy DIY because you saw it in a crazy house and you're like, surely I can have that at my budget. And it's just like, I should have just been like good for her and moved on.
I learned the DIY hard lessons early in my life and have never made them since.
I'm not a DIY girl.
No, not in the least, because I mean, listen, with like a very, very simple project, like that is very low stakes and not load bearing, sure. But I've learned over the years that like I have, you know, in my home, for example, like 5 maybe long-term renovation projects I would like to do. They will happen over the course of a decade, I'm sure. And they will all be done by professionals. Because I think for me, when it, like DIY culture for certain things, and listen, if you're a talented carpenter, my mother is an incredibly talented carpenter. She can make really amazing stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm not anti-DIY because I think it's beneath me. It's because I'm bad at it.
100%.
To be completely clear.
If you are good at it and you want to do it, I think that's wonderful. If not, I think often what I found with bad DIY, as opposed to either waiting until I could afford to do it properly or finding, you know, thrifting things or whatever the alternative might be, is that you find yourself, first of all, it's often a waste of time and resources, but even if you're able to pull it off, I think you always sort of have that feeling of like, this is a shadow of the thing that I wanted. This is not quite, you know, and what I wanted about that thing is like you were saying earlier, there was a whole context, a whole life around it, a whole space around it that made it as aspirational as it was and made it so desirable to me. And you would be much better off trying to find things that really fit your space. Now, don't get me wrong. Again, I do want to stress, like, if you're doing like the IKEA Billy bookcase bookshelf hack and making them into built-ins, and you can do it as a carpenter, go off. I know multiple people who've been able to do that. And if it fits in your space, like there's a bunch of constraints on that. But as it pertains to like trying to like, and this is something I see Gen Z doing a lot, is like building pieces of furniture out of like MDF and like foam and pipe cleaners and stuff like that.
Marshmallow toothpick, like tower chairs.
I do think for most people, you'd probably be better off either waiting a bit or maybe hitting up a flea market.
Yeah. And I do think what you said about the proximity point is interesting. Again, another trite quote that I love to belabor because I do think it's worth repeating. Whatever that quote is about, like, why would you want to be second rate somebody else when you could be first rate yourself? Mm-hmm. I do think that a lot of personal style also revolves around this sort of like living in somebody else's shadow. And a lot of our personal style mantras or descriptions or comments, especially on social media, I know I've done a good job maybe when people, not everyone likes my outfit, and when I don't get compared to people, because there's something about seeing content on TikTok that a lot of people are like, I'm going to have a Lorelai Gilmore fall, or I'm going to have a Carrie Bradshaw, whatever. And it's all in good fun, obviously. I'm not against like a Stars Hollow style pumpkin picking activity. But in the context of personal style and sort of building an aesthetic life and a wardrobe, it is weird to think that there's sometimes a lot of things that are aspirational. And then when you get it, you only can look at that thing and think of somebody else. And I think it's a good tenet of interior decorating and tastemaking and personal style when you look at something and only think of yourself. Like if I buy something and I'm like, oh, I love this, it's so Carrie Bradshaw. Well, then why do I need to own it? I'm not Carrie Bradshaw, I'm me. And that's something I also had to sort of like unpack in my taste and my style, that I don't need to be second rate somebody else. Like the way that I am able to put things together at whatever level I'm at and my taste is me, and I like it because it's mine, not because that thing puts me in closer proximity to an idealized version of my life. Or like when I look at a purchase and I fantasize about somebody else's life, or there's the thought bubble in my head has like a life that I don't live, I know that's not a good purchase for me, versus if I can look in my head. And I know this whole thing is about like not buying into style, but when I am purchasing things, if the idea that I have in my head is a fantasy of my life right now, I know it's probably a worthwhile purchase.
Oh, because of your life. Okay, yes. Got it.
Like if I see an item and I can picture myself just walking my dog Ziggy to the subway, I'm like, oh, well, that's the life that I live. So that is probably
in alignment. It's not some idealized version that doesn't exist.
You know, I'm teeter-tottering down the sidewalk in my heels coming from Zero Bond or something with like
a... What's that?
VC Zero Bond? Some crazy like...
Is that a store?
I don't even know what it is actually, which... This is one of those things you just throw around, and then when somebody asks, you're like, well, I don't know. It's an idea, really. I think it's like Soho House. It's like some sort of fancy, flashy membership type thing. But it's, you know what I mean? Like, you have something, a purchase that you want, and you think of, you know, if you don't see reality in your head, that's a red flag when you're picturing 100%. The purchase, to put it more simply.
Well, you know, this conversation was very Pigma. It wasn't Carrie Bradshaw. It wasn't even Lorelai Gilmore. It was very Pig Mommy. Thank you so much for coming, Heather.
Thank you for having me and letting me rattle for an hour on the financial confessions.
This was such a delight. I could continue this conversation for hours. We might have to go grab lunch and keep chatting.
We may have to.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in. And thank you, Heather, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we will see you back here next Monday for an all-new episode of the Financial Confessions. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.